I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the U.S.-Russia-Ukraine standoff and more escalation. Today, we are going to explore what is actually occurring in the Ukraine, what role, if any, has the United States and its allies played in this, how does this benefit the neocons in Washington, why has the mainstream media, particularly what is considered the liberal media, the Washington Post, the New York Times, MSNBC, failed to review the information objectively and fairly. Even programs, popular programs on Pacifica, have aligned themselves first with the destruction of Libya, then with the invasion of Syria, with the bombing of Syria, or regime change, and also with the Ukrainians against the Russians as if it were all a one-sided issue. And hence, the American public is confused or misinformed on all of the particulars. My first panelist today from Northern Georgia is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. He is one of today's most progressive political and economic writers and commentators on the state of the nation. He examines government dysfunction, political corruption, global and domestic economic threats, the war on terror, Wall Street, and the decline in human values in American society. He was the chairman of the Institute for the Study of Political Economy. He was also a former Assistant Secretary of Treasury during the Reagan administration. And during his academic career, he has taught at many universities, and he held the William Simon Chair in Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Georgetown University. He blogs, and you can find him at paulcraigroberts.org, and he is a frequent contributor to Global Research, The Trends Journal, Counterpunch, and others. He was an associate editor at The Wall Street Journal and has published many books and articles during the past 40 years, his latest being How America Was Lost from 9/11 to the Police Warfare State. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleased to be with you, Gary.
After former President Bill Clinton and his administration broke almost every agreement Gorbachev and George Bush Sr. made following the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, there has been a culture within American foreign policy to continually encroach on Russia's domestic policies and democracy. Yeltsin was an extraordinarily weak president who gave away a lot of concessions to the U.S. and this led to the kind of capitalist anarchy functioning under the rubric of the U.S.-supported democracy. And regardless of what people might think of Putin, he has lifted Russian society substantially because he has accomplished this by focusing upon Russia's internal strengths rather than being a puppet to the Washington consensus. And any country that does not bow to the Washington consensus is quickly regarded as a global pariah and potential enemy of the United States. And besides the U.S. staged coup in Ukraine to push NATO closer to Russia's borders, the U.S. has been undermining Russia both internally by supporting anti-Putin factions as well as geopolitically. Now, you've written about this intervention as America's fifth column. The real question is why? Why can't the U.S. simply respect the sovereignty of other nations, even if those nations don't espouse U.S. hypocrisy, nor are posing any military threat? And Libya and now Venezuela are both examples. And why does the U.S. increasingly perceive Russia as a major global threat? And what do you believe is the mission of the U.S.'s fifth column? Your observations, the forum is yours.
Gary, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it caused a big change in the foreign policy outlook in Washington. The neoconservatives had been gaining power. They were first in office in the Reagan administration, although he removed them, fired them. Some were prosecuted. They made a comeback with Clinton and the attack on Yugoslavia and then Serbia, and they completely dominated the George W. Bush administration, and they also dominate the Obama administration. Now, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the neoconservatives said, oh, look, there's no longer any constraint on American power. The Soviets are gone, and so there's nobody to constrain us. And they said that this was history's choice of American democratic capitalism as the final social system. And they penned what is known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which says that the principal objective of American foreign policy is to prevent the rise of any other country that could serve as a constraint on Washington's hegemony. And so, initially, with Yeltsin, Russia did not serve as a constraint. The neoconservatives got busy with their wars in the Middle East, and Putin came along and sort of rebuilt Russia and reestablished it and showed that the United States again had a constraint. This occurred when the Obama regime had prepared for the invasion of Syria, and Putin said no. And it occurred also when the regime, the Obama regime, was prepared to bomb Iran, and Putin said no. And he offered diplomatic solutions to both of those situations that Washington had to accept. So the neoconservatives said, oh my goodness, we've not been paying attention. Look, this power has arisen that serves as a constraint. And they shifted their attention from the Middle East to Russia, and they realized that the soft spot was Ukraine. Washington had attempted to capture Ukraine in 2004 when Washington was behind the Orange Revolution. The revolution happened, but it failed to deliver Ukraine into Washington's hands. And so Washington, according to Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State, had spent $10 billion in the intervening years between 2004 and I think it was 2014, wasn't it? February of 2014, when Washington launched the coup in Ukraine. They'd spent $5 billion on organizing NGOs, non-governmental organizations in Ukraine, people who could be called into the streets and protest, and they had also spent some of the money cultivating politicians who would line up with Washington's interest. And so they were in a position to act when the president of Ukraine decided against joining the EU. He realized that this would completely disrupt the economic relationships that Ukraine had with Russia, which were far more important than any possibilities Ukraine had with the European Union. And so he said, well, it's not in our interest. And this refusal was used to set off the protest, which then became violent and overthrew the government. So it was done by the neoconservatives in order to weaken Russia, in order to present Russia with security threat. I think Washington hoped to capture the entirety of the Ukraine, including Crimea, because that's where the Russian warm water port is. That's their only access to the Mediterranean. And this would have been a militarily crippling blow to Russia. But as we know, the Crimeans quickly acted themselves and voted their independence of Ukraine, and then asked Russia to reincorporate them into the Russian Republic, where they had resided for several centuries prior to Khrushchev transferring Crimea into the Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic of the Soviet Union. So, frustrated on that score, massive propaganda began against Russia, that it had invaded Ukraine and annexed Ukrainian territory. And as you know, we've had subsequent events, such as the downing of the Malaysian airliner, that were instantly blamed on Russia before there was any evidence one way or the other. And the sort of demonization of Russia was used by Washington for imposing sanctions. And the main purpose of the sanctions is to break up the political and economic relationships between Europe and Russia. These are very these were very strong relationships economically. Europe is heavily dependent on Russian energy, and the growing trade between Russia and Europe worried Washington that it might lose control of its European vassal states because of the growing political and economic relationships with Russia. So Washington took advantage of the crisis that Washington had created in Ukraine and its successful demonization of Russia, and forced the Europeans to comply with the American sanctions as a way of breaking off the economic and political relationships between Europe and Russia. So in that sense, it has worked for Washington, at least in the short or intermediate run. In the long run, it may work against Washington because these sanctions are very costly to Europe. I've concluded they're actually very helpful to Russia because they're forcing Russia to develop more internally and to rely less on the export of commodities, but to learn to produce its own kinds of technology and manufactured goods. And so, and it's also, caused a big shift in Russian focus from Europe to Asia. We now have the Russian-Chinese alliance. We have the BRICS organization between China, India, Russia, Brazil, South Africa. This organization has disavowed settling their trade balances between each other in dollars. This organization have created their own form of the International Monetary Fund. They have their own bank now, capitalized with $100 billion. And the process of moving away from the use of dollar in international trade has begun. So the long-run effects of Washington's move against Ukraine, against Russia, may well be to unwind the American empire.
Just a, I'd like a little more insight, please, on how these Russian oligarchs got powerful, because when I met with a manager of their money about 7 years ago in the Bahamas, there was a conference of money managers, people who oversaw the Vatican's finances. A man from Japan said he oversaw almost 45 of the leading families' money. And there was a guy from Russia. He oversaw 16 oligarchs' money. And this long conversation I had with him, the guy from Russia said, these guys are not highly educated, but they were in the right place at the right time, and they had a combination of both government corrupt people, organized crime in many cases, but also none of this would have happened without the people from the United States coming in and forcing the Russian people to go through a shock doctrine because they were giving up everything the state had provided, guaranteed work, guaranteed health care, guaranteed apartments or homes. So all their guarantees, guaranteed food, they had none of that now. And he said, no one in America could have had any idea how much suffering this brought to the Russian people. Now, mind you, this is a Russian I'm speaking to who was alive and well at that time and telling me about what they went through. And he said, yet some people from America, I believe he mentioned Larry Summers and some others, did extraordinarily well, but they were the ones who allowed many of the scenarios to play out following that. Could you give us your insight into that time?
Yes. No one expected the Soviet collapse. The United States did not expect it, and neither did Gorbachev. This was a sudden, unexpected thing. And consequently, there were no plans on how to handle such an unexpected transformation. Soviet enterprises didn't really work on the price and profit system. There's no time to go into how it worked, but it didn't work in the way Western firms are run. And the ownership was socialized. It was state. So what to do with all of these things? And the solution that was more or less hit upon was that all of the state property would be issued in the form of shares to the population and distributed. It needed to have been done with far more security, maybe in the form of mutual funds, and maybe with limits on when it could be sold. For example, maybe they should have been required to keep it for 5 years or something. But what happened, a lot of people got these shares and didn't know what they were. And as you said, they had lost their jobs, they had lost their subsidies, they were starving. And so it was very easy for foreign money to come in there to finance people. And I think a lot of American and Israeli money went in. And that this is probably the basis of some of those oligarchs. But this money came in and bought up all these shares. So what was supposed to have been distributed in general to the population to give them a stake in the birth of capitalism in Russia instead ended up in the hands of a few oligarchs. Now, some of these oligarchs were financed, I think, in the way I said, with foreign money. Others, as you said, were simply party bosses on the scene. People used to exercising and asserting authority, and they just simply privatized for themselves. And that's how the assets became concentrated in such few hands. And, of course, the shock doctrine may have been constructed by Larry Summers and that other one, I forget his name at the moment, in order to facilitate the concentration of wealth in few hands. It would have been a way of controlling, of continuing to control Russia through the few people that had been put in these positions of vast wealth. So by disrupting people's livelihoods and creating tremendous uncertainty, the shock doctrine was a way to guarantee they would quickly turn loose of their shares for whatever they could get. So that's sort of a brief oversight. It's more detailed and complicated, but it gives you the basic notion of how that occurred.
Okay, thank you for that. Here is a large overarching issue both philosophical, pragmatic, and practical, and somewhat existential. But I believe we must, as a society, ask ourselves a basic question that we're not just discussing. Russia has made enormous progress on some levels. Certainly, if you were to go to St. Petersburg, if you were to go to Moscow, you would not know if you were on the street walking down some of the boulevards at this time of year that you were not in some of the main streets of America. Some of their apartments, their complexes, the suburban sprawl, the highly affluent upper middle class of professionals. You go to China, you see the same thing. You put those two together, you have one of the, if not the largest group of affluent upper mobile people on the planet. India is not far behind. And yet, none of these people want to lose what has been created and sacrificed for and worked hard for. Not in China, not in Russia. Any attack against China would send the entire world economy into a major spasm. The same against Russia. Besides, on the existential side, why in the world would any American assume that we have the military might to have a war with Russia or China with their vast armies and intelligence and satellites and nuclear capacities when we, with all of our might, could not defeat a ragtag army of Taliban or insurgents in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq? And yet, with even under those circumstances and failures, or even in Vietnam, we're now saying, we're posturing. I see the editorials. I see the blogs about how, with Bill O'Reilly leading it, you know, and Sean Hannity, let's put boots on the ground. And now they're posturing against China and Russia as if we're going to have a war. And exactly what would we gain and how much would we lose? And does anyone have an understanding of the consequences of going up against countries that are not possibly going to be defeated by the United States, but could virtually destroy the country? Your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, I've stressed for several years the great danger of nuclear war because of the arrogance and hubris of the United States. You have to understand that Washington is full of itself. It's got enormous hubris, enormous arrogance. It insists that American laws take supremacy over the laws of other countries in their own countries. It insists that anyone who doesn't follow American policy is a threat. In other words, if you're a country with an independent foreign policy, you are regarded as a threat that has to be removed. That was Saddam Hussein. That was Gaddafi in Libya. That's the Iranians. And now it's the Russians and Chinese. And so hubris and arrogance makes mistakes. I mean, and people continue making these mistakes with regard to Russia. I mean, even people with massive military capabilities, such as Napoleon and Hitler, have the kinds of hubris and arrogance that destroyed them from marching into Russia. The neocons have the same thing. And despite our inability to win these various wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan, Washington still thinks that it can push around anybody that it wants to at any time. Earlier this century, there was actually an article published in Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, in which two so-called experts concluded that Russia was so weak that the United States could knock them out with the first nuclear strike, and that the Russians would have so little left they wouldn't dare retaliate because they would be faced with a second strike. And when you have that kind of myth-making in prominent foreign policy journals, you can see how stupid are the people that are in power and are forming these policies and making these kinds of decisions. I mean, if you just think about the Wolfowitz doctrine, which declares that it's the first objective of the United States to prevent the rise of Russia. Well, how in the world is the United States going to prevent the rise of Russia? Russia was always well-armed. And the fact that it lost its empire didn't mean that Russia disappeared. It's still the largest country on Earth in terms of geographical expanse. And as Gorbachev pointed out the other day, there's a Russian missile that in this country, it's known as Satan, and its destructive capability is the equivalent of 100 Chernobyls. That's one missile. And they've got loads of these things and always have had. So it is it's an act of insanity to destroy trust between nuclear powers. And that's what the Bush and Obama administration have done. In fact, it began with Clinton, with the Clinton attack on Yugoslavia and Serbia. These were Russian allies, and Russia was too weak to do anything about it, but they're not now. So what we have witnessed in the 21st century is the undoing of all the good that Reagan and Gorbachev achieved. I just posted yesterday on my site an interview of a German magazine with Gorbachev, in which he talks about the accomplishments that he and Reagan did to get rid of nuclear weapons, that both of them saw them as horrible things that shouldn't exist, and how they worked together. Well, now all this is reversed. The Russians know that they are target. And so, again, they're developing their strategic forces. And the Chinese know that they're target. And you may remember, we maybe even talked about it on a program. A year or two ago, the Chinese leaked out how, if they're attacked, that their missiles would completely destroy the United States. And they put this out trying to produce some kind of realism in Washington, because Washington had this war plan on how we were going to attack China. So it is an insanity to have Washington completely destroy the trust between Russia and Washington and China and Washington, because gaining that trust, you know, President John F. Kennedy began that with Khrushchev. They both saw how close things came in the Cuban Missile Crisis. They said, wow, we don't want anything like that ever again. We've got to have trust between us. And it was the principal goal of Reagan. And he had to fight the military security complex in the United States in order to make the kinds of agreements he reached with Gorbachev. And it was also a principal goal of the George Herbert Walker Bush administration and James Baker. And they gave the guarantees to Gorbachev that there would not, that NATO would not move one inch to the east should the Russians permit the reunification of Germany. So all of these accomplishments have been flushed down the toilet by George W. Bush and Obama. And it's because their administrations are neocon administrations. These are neoconservative administrations. Neoconservatives are fanatics. They're ideologues. They're committed to American hegemony over their entire world. And they will go to nuclear war in order to achieve that. And this is the fundamental problem.
Well, final question. The Pentagon has now been stating that climate change and global warming are the greatest threats the U.S. faces for its national security. And many futurists and experts in the geopolitics of climate change that have brought on this program, such as Christian Parenti and John Caste and Gwen Dyer, are convinced that future wars and conflicts will be increasingly focused on access to resources like water, oil. And we are already witnessing this in some degree behind the current wars and conflicts. And compared to the U.S. and Russia, in my opinion, it is better poised for a more preposterous future as climate change further alters global geopolitics. So I would think that working together to allow cooperation rather than posturing for war, which does not engage people in wanting to help you, help your water problems. And by the way, you mentioned that Russia is the largest continental planet on Earth. Well, they have the largest amount of boreal forest. They have the largest water reserves. They have the largest growing fields. They have more land able and rich in nutrients to grow than any other place on the planet. So when it comes, they have the oil, they have the gold, they have so many natural resources. China doesn't have that. Russia does. So at the end of the day, wouldn't you think that we have 20 states that are in severe drought and four that are in extreme drought, including California, which is going to see over the next 5 years its agriculture substantially reduced, not only because of drought, but because of bee depopulation, the colony collapse, and therefore not being able to pollinate crops, including almonds, by the way. And so we're doing just about everything backwards and wrong when it comes to our domestic issue and our foreign issue. Shouldn't we be tempered in this by people who are wiser and do not have regime change and politics as their only advocates?
Well, of course, yes. How are we going to get these people? You see, the United States is an oligarchy. It's run by the military security complex that President Dwight Eisenhower warned us about. This is an extremely powerful private interests. And war, or the threat of war, is very important. Their profits depend on that, their position. And they control enough members of the House and Senate, and enough presidential appointees to administrations, to be sure that we're at war or on the verge of war, or that they are needed, and that the budget flows to them. Then we have Wall Street, which is sort of a metaphor for the top financial elites. They want financial hedge enemy over the world. And, of course, that is furthered by American political or military hedge enemy. So those two powerful groups are united. And then, of course, we have the Israel lobby. And they want Israel's purposes served, and those also emerge with the American military security complex and Wall Street. So there you have three very powerful forces. Between them, they can determine who's in the House, who's in the Senate, who's in the White House, who's the Secretary of State, who's the Secretary of Defense, and so on. And then, of course, we have the extractive industries, oil, timber, mining, and we have agribusiness. Now, these last two, the extractive industries and agribusiness, have done a lot to destroy the environment and the water resources. You may know that just this week we had 3 million gallons of toxic sludge floating down two western rivers into Lake Powell from one mine. Water resources in many places now are essentially destroyed. They're already polluted, or if they're aquifers, they're drawn down. The two largest lakes in the West, on which the entire West is dependent, they're drying up. It's kind of hard to have a war over resources when there's not any. At least not. Here are endangered from the activities of corporations and land developers.
I want to go
and ranchers and that sort of thing. So
I want to circle back so that the audience really has a clear understanding of why we decided to support a coup in the Ukraine, because with that understanding, then everything else that follows makes more sense, because the American media refuses to acknowledge that Victoria Nuland over at the State Department, even though she was caught with planning some of this, and it was broadcast, the media didn't pick up on it. And there was a recent report on RTV that I believe is newsworthy for better understanding the U.S.'s motivation behind its backing of fascist factions in Ukraine. The Ukraine government has now signed a deal with a U.S. energy construction firm, Frontera Resources Corporation, which will build a liquefied natural gas terminal in Ukraine. So clearly there is an American foreign policy strategy to further cut off gas flow between Russia and European nations. And earlier it was reported that Monsanto and other U.S. chemical AG firms are involved in large operations in Ukraine's breadbasket at a time when Russia has declared a moratorium on GMOs. Russia will not allow any genetically modified organisms in their food. And at this moment, Ukraine is being raped by rapid privatization, being handed over to American and European multinational corporations, and all in defiance of relations with Russia. So what is your assessment of what the U.S. and NATO are trying to shape Ukraine into, particularly by supporting and aiding fascist neo-Nazi factions, which, by the way, is worrying other European countries' populations on Ukraine's border?
Well, Gary, it's true the American corporations will loot Ukraine. There's no doubt about it. But that isn't the purpose of the policy. That's just them being opportunistic and taking advantage of what's sitting there. The purpose of the policy of the American coup, of the Washington's coup, in Ukraine was directed at Russia, because Ukraine has been a part of Russia itself for centuries. And the way the Soviet Union was organized, it took various parts and called them separate socialist Soviet republics. Why they did this is largely for propaganda purposes, and we don't need to go into that. But the Ukraine has been part of Russia longer than the United States has existed, and became separate only with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Largely, it was something orchestrated by Washington. Now, the reason for the coup is to weaken Russia. Originally, they said, look, if we grab the Ukraine, we can force the Russians out of their Black Sea naval base, because the Russians were occupying Crimea under a lease agreement. And if there's a change in regime, then the lease possibly could be canceled, or certainly it could not be renewed when it ran out. So there was a direct threat at Russian military capability. This was one reason for grabbing the Ukraine. The second reason was to be able to produce lots of dissension inside Russia about the loss of Ukraine, because it was still economically attached to Russia, and of course the Russians and Ukrainians are attached through centuries of intermarriage, and it would cause all kinds of discontent. And when Washington was preempted by Crimea returning to Russia, then the crisis was used to demonize Russia, accuse them, and use it to break up the economic and political relationships with Europe. The looting of the country, that's just opportunistic for the corporations, and it's possible because the Ukrainian government was put in office by Washington. Their prime minister was chosen by Victoria Nuland. We have the recorded conversation. It's available still on YouTube, where Victoria Nuland and the American ambassador in Kiev outline the members of the government that they're going to install, and lo and behold, they did. So it's a stooge government. It serves Washington. Washington has made it clear that it's not really interested in resolving that conflict because it's detrimental for Russia, particularly Russia's relations with Europe. And the Minsk agreements that the Germans and the French worked out between Russia and the American puppet government in Ukraine, this agreement is not being followed by Ukraine simply because Washington won't permit it. And so the conflict that broke out between other parts of Ukraine, present-day Ukraine, that were originally Russian territories, these conflicts are likely to soon be very active. The two breakaway republics that asked also to be reincorporated in Russia, but were refused by Putin because he thought that would be too provocative and he was trying to use diplomacy with Europe. If they ask again, if the conflict renews and it's clear to the Russian government that Washington has no interest in the conflict being resolved, the only way it can be resolved would be for the Russian government to accept the request on the parts of these two breakaway republics to be also reunited with Russia. Because one thing is clear, and that is Ukraine will not attack Russia. And there's no possibility of the Ukraine fighting Russia. And for that matter, there's no possibility of NATO fighting Russia. NATO would be instantly destroyed. And that is why the war would be nuclear. The United States and NATO have no capability of invading Russia.
Well, that's the bottom line to it.
That's the bottom line. And so what happens, and this is what I keep warning about, it's very easy for Washington in its hubris and arrogance to keep pushing this thing and then finding it out on a limb and can't back down. Oh, we'll lose face, push the button. That's right. The kind of fools that govern the United States. You know, I spent 25 years with them in Washington. These are not intelligent people. They're cunning. They're savage. They have no morality.
Well, see, I think you're being very generous. I view Washington, D.C. as one giant toilet overflowing. I wish someone could pull the plunger and flush it.
Well,
thank you very much for being on today. We're out of time. And a great appreciation for all your good work.
Well, Gary, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're always well-prepared and very much on top of things. And thank you for your interest.
Thank you. Dr. Paul Greg Roberts. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our next guest. Please stay with us. Let us now go to my guest who is standing by and say hello. to Kermit Herzog in California. Nice to have you with us today, Kermit.
Thank you, Gary, for having me on your show. And I've just listened to a powerful message given by you these past few minutes. Very powerful.
Thank you. Kermit, the current Ukrainian crisis and the new Cold War standoff between the United States and Russia over the Ukraine is not a momentary blip in the history of U.S. Eastern European relations. Ukraine has been a strategic geopolitical interest for America's imperial interventions for a long time, particularly as the former national security advisor for President Carter, Brzezinski, and later as a strategic consultant for Obama and Hillary Clinton. And the Ukraine's role in Brzezinski's grand chessboard scheme is pivotal. So please begin with some of the past background about the role of the Ukraine in the U.S. confrontational agenda with Russia, and in what ways has Brzezinski influenced Obama's position towards Russia, and finally the role of the right-wing neocon contingent and their supporting neocon on the left, which handpicked the Ukraine's new leaders and its agenda to ignite a larger conflict with Putin. The forum is yours.
Okay. I think we start here with basically how has the West brought itself to this position? And I'll start off with how has it been so thoroughly checkmated? And this is basically a rundown of the leaders we have and why we are where we are. In my opinion, the reasons are pretty clear. Western leaders have unfortunately been replaced by ideologues, sycophants, and political courtesans, to, if I may be accurate. Money determines their course of action, what or who they listen to or don't listen to, and their morality or immorality. In truth, the more accurate definition of our leaders would be replacement stewards, because they're really not leaders. Ukraine really is a glaring example of this really having gone to the dogs. But let's get back to the types of leaders. And basically, these are the people that have set us up in what is a dramatically and quickly deteriorating situation with, as Professor Cohen, Professor Chomsky, and others have said, is a slippery slope to thermonuclear war. But our ideologues adhere to their ideology, regardless of the facts or the changing world circumstances. The sycophants and the courtesans are beholden to their masters, oligarchs, or the highest bidder briber. And the Western oligarchs, this is characterizing who these people are dangerously out of touch with reality and only interested in their anachronistic fiefdoms in many cases, so their profits. So their strategy is at best stale, and this is the 1%. Thus, at the highest levels, our leaders are generally poorly qualified, deathly afraid of pragmatism, generally unethical, but worst of all, and the reason that I point to for being where we are in Ukraine, is that we are completely bereft of diplomats, or those who have diplomatic skills at the highest level of government. Our diplomats will call a world leader a Hitler, a Satan, a thug, ugly even, very quickly, just after they've shaken that leader's hand and just before they plot regime change to kill that world leader in his or her own country. And this is not a diplomat, and this is the major source of the problem that we have going on right now in Ukraine. We were not gifted with statesmen and diplomats to help avoid this and to see the grand chessboard strategy for what it is, a failed ideology.
Okay. Yes, I appreciate that insight. But explain, if you would, add on, please, how this entire conflict has been orchestrated and then blamed exclusively upon Russia, and not showing that we needed this conflict. This is a regime change in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And how? What is our motive? Why would we want to risk a confrontation with Russia? We could never beat Russia. We couldn't. Look what we didn't do in we didn't do it in Vietnam. We didn't do it in Afghanistan and Iraq. Do you really think, anyone really think, that we're going to go in there with one of the largest, most sophisticated armies in the world and beat Russia? So what is our motive?
What we're witnessing in Ukraine is the final the finale of the grand chessboard strategy made flesh. And if I may say up front, the results of which, metaphorically speaking, are entirely indistinguishable from what Mary Shelley wrote in Frankenstein. It's all gone horribly wrong. But the grand chessboard strategy that really began its life as the Heartland Theory in 1918 by Sir Halford Mackinder has turned out to be a colossal failure. And whether it was a methodology or the actual theory itself really doesn't matter. What it does is that the ongoing drama in Ukraine has the near-term potential to make Vietnam and even World War II appear small blips on the history of warfare and death. But regarding a few ways or a few of the important points that the West tried to establish via its grand chessboard strategy, the first was to exert control over Eurasia via the control of Russia's geopolitical, geostrategic, and geofinancial destiny, and thus to isolate it, and this extends to China as well. The goal, to keep them vassals of the West and powerless. Mackinder referred to this as the Heartland Theory, wherein if you controlled the heartland of Eurasia and Africa, then you were the power. You were the person in charge. Well, this has not turned out exactly as they would have liked it to, but let's go on to some of the other tenets that they tried to establish. The second was to control Europe, ostensibly, as a vassal state to U.S. power and its relationship with Russia by the division of Eurasia via a renewed Cold War, what we are seeing is unfolding along a new Iron Curtain that has magically moved right up to Russia's border, though there are those within NATO in the West who would like you to believe that it was the other way around and that Russia somehow magically moved towards its borders, its NATO bases. And the third point, the reason why this goes on to date, despite the many failures, is to enshrine U.S. hegemony via the dollar's role as reserve currency, petrodollar, and to thereby guarantee the use of strong-arm diplomacy by the West in the form of we take what we want when we want it, for at least a while. These are the key tenets that really have us driving eastward, that have us assuming Poland and Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, and a good number of others, really, based on this grand chessboard strategy, have either been checkmated already or will be in the near term, again, as a direct result of this final chessboard gambit. If I may recount how they've been checkmated, Russia right now is far from being isolated or controlled, as witnessed by its active participation in numerous and growing geopolitical, geostrategic, and geofinancial organizations. The BRICS organizations, the BRICS banks, the Eurasian Union, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Asian Infrastructure Bank are all testaments to Russia's full integration of what's being called the alter world. And our leaders, again, I can't really call them leaders, they're more stewards, really have no clue of what's happening, as demonstrated by the grand board chessboard strategy that has allied Russia. This is very big. The country with the largest supply of nuclear missiles in the world, at this point, superior weapons technology, and I can touch on that if you like shortly. An incredible natural gas resources with China, the country that has the world's largest GDP, tremendous capital reserves, and a manufacturing infrastructure that will soon be, if it isn't already, second to none. Add to the mix, Russia and China have to date negotiated over $1 trillion in win-win business deals. The importance of this, those contracts were all denominated in yuan and rubles, not dollars. This, again, is the mother of all fails or checkmates for the architects of the grand chessboard strategy. But there's much more. So they forge ahead with this strategy, and they lose every consecutive time. But number two are the hairline fissures that began running through the EU at the start of the U.S.-Ukrainian coup. Well, they're now turning into very noticeable fractures. A number of EU multinationals openly defied the embargoes against Russia, and EU leaders increasingly voiced their opposition by way of their respective medias, intellectuals, and their business class. The fractures widen every day. This is a check waiting to be a checkmate. Another thing that is basically unfolded as a result of the grand chessboard strategy, or the failure of its implementation, is that Western financial institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, Wall Street, the rating agencies, and even the SWIFT systems are all challenged now by rivals from the East, developed by new best friends for life, Russia and China. Interestingly enough, compelled into each other's arms by the West, another catastrophic fail. So this really is what is happening. The main tenets of this strategy have been and are being defeated. And I understand why this is causing great consternation now and why they know nothing other but to wrap up, because their policies over the past 50 years have been predicated on warfare, not diplomacy. So that, I guess, kind of explains how those tenets, you know, have fallen to the wayside, so to speak.
I appreciate these insights. And you've given us the larger picture. So we had best understand the takeaway message for us is that the United States has been posturing behind the scenes in front of the world. They just have this ongoing obsession with power, and there's just no way that we're going to checkmate Russia and China. And now Russia and China are working together, and we are clueless, but the neocons have always been clueless, so the people who got us into the Iraq War are the same people who would love to get us into another war. And you're saying, Kermit, these are not the people we should believe. We should not look at the old grand chessboard, as your book says, Ukraine, as a big grand chessboard and how the West was checkmated. And you are right, and I thank you very much for your scholarship and for your tenacity on letting us know the truth, irrespective of what the mainstream media refuses to accept. All the best on this. And the website is taynelane.com. Look forward to our next conversation. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.